I'm Dustin Zahn, and this is Trainwrecks. Be sure to check out other episodes on all your favorite streaming platforms. Follow the podcast on Instagram at trainwrecks.69. Like and subscribe, leave reviews, tell a friend, come to my shows, all that good shit. So today is a guest that is a very old friend of mine. He goes by Joel Mull. And I actually have zero notes for this because we kind of just threw this in last minute while you're here for a gig.
That's how we do.
Yeah. Say hello to everybody.
Back to back. Hey.
That's right. As far as other things to announce, I've been pretty quiet this winter because, oh, yeah, The Great Beyond, that's going on. I think tickets are, they're almost sold out. If you're listening a couple months into the future, it's a done deal. You can buy them secondhand, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be sold out by that point. Great lineup. I don't have the notes in front of me because, as I said, we kind of just threw this one together. But some of the bigger acts on there, you got Surgeon, Devious One, some upcoming names like Filippa Pacho, who I actually met through Joel. Yeah, so check it out. That's happening the last weekend of July. And do you have anything you want to plug while we're at it?
What happened the past couple of months or what's coming in the future?
Podcasts, anything, remixes?
I got a Grab the Groove podcast coming up next week. I don't know when we're listening to this. And then I'm doing a Parable podcast as well. And that's it. I'm pushing for the new label as well.
That's right. We're going to get into all that today. So let's jump into it. Should we go into the music stuff or should we go into the fun stuff first?
You know, you choose. I mean.
All right. Fun stuff.
Fun stuff.
Epstein files. Let's go. I don't want to talk about that today. I did read this morning, though, is they were saying Obama admitted that aliens are real.
Oh,
did
yeah.
Did you read that?
Yeah. That got me up pretty fast.
That's right. I sent that to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, probably, of course they do, you know.
But what was the name of the Federation Space something? What was it called? The
Space Force.
No, Space Federation. It was something like that. Alien Federation or some weird name.
That they were talking to him on Mars.
Yeah, that was the name of the alien community.
I got to reread that. I mean, that's a bit generic, right?
Yeah. Why would the aliens call themselves
Alien Federation?
Yeah, like.
It's like the old show Kung Fu with a lot of Kung Fu, and it was just called Kung Fu. They really thought hard about that one.
Kung Fu Masters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was fun. Really, that's about all that's slightly. There's plenty of entertaining news.
It can get serious with aliens too, you know?
Here's the deal. I don't see any way in where meeting aliens is ever going to work out as a net positive for us because there's no reason they want to help us. And the other part of it is like, that means they are by far a superior species because of their capabilities. So it's like, we're basically just food at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they just look at us, they're like, you know, we're the weird people out in the sticks, living out in the forest. Like, just leave them alone. They're fucking trashy.
I mean, there's going to be 9 billion of us at some point, and they're like, oh, maybe we just got to stock up on the fresh goods, you know?
Exactly. There was this, have you seen that show Pluribus?
No.
On Apple?
No, I missed that one.
It's by the Breaking Bad people.
Okay, yeah, yeah, right.
Thing
yeah,
going on.
Right. I couldn't watch the Breaking Bad. It just got my really anxiety level. I watched like couple of episodes, and then I was like, so awkward situations and stressful, and I can't watch this. I know it's good. It's good acting. It's good score. Everything is really good, but it's just, I couldn't take it. I haven't watched that.
I get it.
Yeah.
There's some shows where I have that too, where I'm like, I know this is going to be something good, but I just can't do it.
Yeah, I stopped with the zombies as well, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of been done. Did you see that? Well, did you see the 28 thing? Something
28
inches
years
longer
later. No, as I watched the intro, and I was like, "Hell no, I can't." It's just I watched the first 28 days later, and that movie—it's
terrifying.
It's incredibly well done. film. To get London that in that still moment where you're just waking up alone completely and you know darkness is lurking around the corner.
Ugh, totally.
Scares the shit out of me.
Actually, I did just thought of this now, kind of an interesting segue. The first track on my drum code album, Monolith, it's called 1984. I wrote that directly after watching that movie.
I wrote
that track in, fuck, when did that movie come out? 2003 or something?
I'm not sure. I just read the book.
Yeah. I wrote it in one take and then I rendered the wave and then the project never opened. So I'm like, well, that's the song.
Okay.
And then it just sat there and eventually came out. But yeah, so crazy shit happens. Yeah. Anyway, we're just saying no more zombies and stuff.
No more stress. It's enough stress going on.
Let's talk about rave zombies.
Yeah.
We're in Berlin, home of them.
Yeah.
You played last night at RSO. You said you had a really good one.
Really, really good. Amazing. A lot of nice people came out, nice faces, and the sound system in there was really
killer sound.
Fantastic.
System.
The sub in the below the low regions, and when you can work with the bass tones in the on a sound system like that in a room like that, it's just such a pleasure. And the booth was dialed in, and the only problem I had was something with my headphones. They were a little bit too low volume. I noticed it the last couple of shows I have. My ears are getting really sensitive to loud volumes.
I'm getting there too.
Yeah. That's, I guess it comes with the territory, but I never really had big problems before, but lately the tinnitus has been acting up, so I'm trying to keep the volume down, but I also want to, crank it and be part of the party. You know?
You got to feel it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you really feel RSO. It was a brilliant night. And also that time slot, like between 4 and 8, is it's not like the start of the night. It's you can kind of build a different crescendo. And it took off yesterday. I'm super happy. I'm cloud 9 today, actually.
Really. Awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has one of, if not the best sound systems in town, for sure. I think it's Kirsch Audio. I could be wrong. If I'm doing the club dirty, I'm sorry. It's been a while since
I haven't checked, attention. Actually. I'm sorry. It's just really good. I don't know the label.
Yeah, it's custom built and
yeah,
everything.
Okay.
And
okay.
Just gigantic speakers.
Yeah, also what strikes me also is the high ceiling thing. It just makes it acoustically, you get that little reverb going, and
exactly.
those percussion things can kind of stand out in the
bounces
in
the, off the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
And, even like with like Berghain, and you got that cutout in the back of the dance floor, technically, where you're coming up the stairs, and it creates that roll.
That's the
acoustics
stuff. That's exactly the theory I have as well.
Well, I mean,
which makes
true.
That place that unique rolling thunder.
Because there are like proper music studios where if you go to it along the floorboards of the room, it looks like it goes in, like you could drop your phone down in it or something, you know what I mean?
Because
it's like, so what some of these rooms have done is it captures the sound and then it goes under the floor or to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably butchering this because I'm not really well-versed in this, but it's kind of the same idea that it kind of generates a different kind of acoustical something or another.
It's this undertone of a rolling feeling that, if you play a kick drum and a bass in an empty space, it creates that little extra hump of flavor and that just rolls differently than in a smaller club or whatever, and it's such a pleasure to play on that sound system as well. Well, hey, being invited playing on the best sound systems in the world is such an amazing job.
Exactly.
I'm super happy.
When I was bringing up that room, I know Steve Albini, the producer legend from Chicago, his place, Electrical Audio, he has that floor that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. If any of the people listening are nerdy enough, you can go on YouTube and there's little videos that talk about it. But anyway, back to what you're saying, it's right. Like getting to play on some of these sound systems is awesome. You know, I remember living in the States, and then you just kind of have to imagine that these records sound great in places. Because if you're lucky, you get to go play at a crappy rave
warehouse.
Like, do you remember, were Serwin Vegas a thing in Europe? The carpeted speakers, and you would see like the subs and cars and shit.
Yeah,
the, you know, like kind of stuff like that at parties. And
oh man, I played on it all, and that's the thing. Also, that creates something special with underground parties where people just go in and set up a sound system and try to kind of flex it and create a good, you know, perfect sound. It will never be, but it will create that dirty, weird sound that also has a flavor and an aspect to it that you feel like, oh, wow, this is, you know. Certain rooms, just especially warehouses, with that long reverb, and you know, you play those tonal things like toms and lower mid kind of tones. They just ring out more in those environments, and it's just, it makes it more spacey. Yeah. I think that's a part of like why like the 90s techno sounded like it did, because we were playing a lot in these kind of environments, like make it yourself. That we didn't have clubs like that in the sense of perfect sound systems.
Yeah.
So warehouses and reverbs and, you know, that feeling of being on a big ship out on sea in the big storm, you know, like...
I mean, acoustics were never, I don't even think people had heard that word. They're like, wait, the guitars or something? Like exactly. In some of these warehouse parties, they just, you just deal with whatever you had.
Yeah.
Nobody was like, oh, do they have a Void Incubus rig tonight or whatever? You just show up.
I know Electro Voice was a thing.
Yep.
Like back then.
Sure, yeah.
And like now there's so many companies.
A lot of really good ones too.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's kind of like... you know, there's all those like small microbreweries that
exactly.
I'm not a beer guy, but I know they do fancy stuff. And
totally.
Now it's same
totally.
With speakers and shit.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, I really like the fact that people take this stuff seriously these days with like trying to have the right sound system and treat the room, and you got to have the right equipment and stuff. But then there's like a certain point where DJs kind of get a little too anal about the gear that's provided. Like, I get it. We got used to it. And I have my setup that I like. And I think if you are a promoter, you should make an effort to provide what's on the list so you can get the best possible solution.
Yeah.
From like, if I book you, like, I want you to do your best, you know?
Yeah.
But like, remember back in the day before before even the Pioneer 500 was a thing, there were just random mixers. You never really knew what you were going to get, and they're all kind of shitty, and you're just like, this is what's provided, deal with it. And now everybody's so anal. Like, you don't have the whatever new mixer or standard mixer, then I won't play, or something like this. And I'm like, well, if you're such a badass, then just use whatever and make it work. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, pick it on red.
Yeah, see, if you ain't redlining, you ain't headlining.
Exactly. No, I learned my first like club gigs that I had back in the 90s when I had my first residency. It was on a Rodec mixer, which was I think it was like 6-channel long faders, and like I remember the EQ was not the best plastic, but so you would actually kind of get almost like when you play the guitar a long time, you get like the fingertips get a little bit sore.
Oh yeah,
and that's how that mixer kind of
you got to get the calluses built
exactly.
up
exactly.
Yeah.
But the faders were so long, so you could do like these long, smooth mixes, and sounded great. That mixer. And Rodec, and then there was the Formula as well. That was the high-end stuff back then.
Yeah, for sure.
And then you had all the consumer stuff.
And whatnot.
Yeah. My first mixer was a Gemini Scratchmaster.
I had a Gemini 626 and a Neumark. The Neumark came first. The 626 came second.
Right.
But what those had that I kind of miss even on modern mixers is the kill switches.
Mm-hmm.
You remember those?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was never a scratcher, so I never used it.
But it was for the EQ. So mm-hmm. for anybody that is under fucking 40, kill switches, like basically it was low, mids, and high bands on. And so if you wanted to cut out the mids, you just flip the switch on the mids and it would kill the mids on that channel completely or whatever.
Yeah, and that's
kind of fun for like creative DJing, especially when you're slamming stuff in. Like now you have filters on that, but it's nice just to have a button to like toggle stuff.
True.
You know?
Yeah, fast cutting. But that's what I love with the Pioneer, the low mid thing and the bass.
Yeah.
That tonal... A creative way of fading away those harsh, not harsh, but they can
like the 300.
Yeah, they can ring a little bit. But if you get that thing right, I love that mixer in that sense. That's my favorite of choice.
What, the Pioneer?
No,
the L&E
92 actually, not the 96.
Yeah, because you said Pioneer at first.
Did I?
Yeah.
Sorry, cross delete.
He found the buttons. We're in trouble now. So there's definitely some people that are younger, and they're like, "Who the hell is this guy?"
Mm.
Let's do a little rewind real quickly. We don't have to go too far back. Well, we do have to go far back, but not too long.
It's probably a long time ago.
You actually, even though you're Swedish, is it safe to say you got your start in Germany?
Yeah, my first work official residency was in Hamburg, 1994. I started DJing a couple of years earlier than that through my schoolmate, Adam Bayer. We went to the same school, and he had a setup at home that he taught me how to play. So that's how I got started. And lucky enough, I got this gig in Hamburg. My mom is from Hamburg, and I met a couple of friends that was like, "Do you want to come to Germany and play?" And I said, "Yes." I quit school and moved down, took my record players with me and records, and started playing regularly, which was kind of amazing, being 19 year and just living life and full excitement for what was so new at the time.
I mean
there was not much going on. Things were starting to happen in Sweden, but it was not regular clubs in that sense that it was every week or so. It was like a little rave scene and stuff.
Yeah.
So I kind of came up in the early periods of at the start of everything, you could say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it just
kind of took off. I saw a video that you reposted recently.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Love Parade.
Yeah.
Was that, what year was that?
That was 1993.
Okay, so it was early enough.
Yeah.
Now, was that, because you were telling me before, was that the trip that you came with Adam and...
Exactly. So we went down with the train and a couple of backpacks and sleeping bags and, you know, arriving Ostbahnhof and putting our bags in the lockers and then just went out
just
for the
it.
Raves. Trying to find what was going on. And we knew about Love Parade. That's that was the big mission. But also the big mission was like record shopping, going to every club that was around. And just, we didn't have a hotel room. There was like showers downstairs at Ostbahnhof. You could pay 5 D-marks and have a shower. And that's what we did. And then during the day, we found some spot in the park and just lay down and slept.
I was going to say, did you sleep?
We didn't need to sleep back then, you know. Yeah. Sleep was not, important.
Was not the priority. Yeah.
And caught this revolution that was going on, you know. Yeah. It was such an excitement and pure adrenaline from just being part of that, the movement that kind of started and then snowballed from there.
Yeah.
And Monday morning come and we sat on the train and going back to Stockholm. Being one of the most life-changing moments in history of Joel Mull.
I bet. I mean, we drastically different, but I guess the American equivalent would probably be Movement Festival in Detroit.
Yeah,
back then it was DEMF
right.
in the beginning, you know, which was definitely instrumental somehow.
But this was also the sign of the time, East Berlin, you know, East Germany coming out of that into this euphoric, life-changing music that was felt like we were part of something unknown and futuristic, very, very positive mindset and just trying to get everyone involved and being the sign of the time. Back then, the 90s was just, it felt amazing. And that kind of set the foundation of why I'm doing this, trying to tap back to that energy and the spirit of seeing people almost leaving their body on the dance floor and
totally
this euphoric life-changing moment that you can have with frequencies,
trying to give that to people or like live vicariously and catch that vibe again or whatever.
Yeah. And that actually comes down to why I started a new label now with that name in Swedish. It's called Stunden, and Stunden is the moment in Sweden, Swedish direct translated. And that's the thing I think we all kind of, that it all boils down to why you want to be in that booth and trying to tell that story so you can reach that moment when you find that, I don't know, even if it's 1 or 5 minutes of the whole night, if you reach that moment and you see on people's faces that we are now where everyone is just aligned in oneness. And that was exactly the thing at Love Parade as well. Everyone knew that this is why we're here. We just want to be in a good spot and be, you know, happy.
Absolutely.
And sometimes that doesn't arrive. That moment doesn't arrive. And I think that's one of the reasons I always get so nervous when I play still, that you want to achieve that moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. That's kind of what keeps me coming back.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it's not, you know, I have a run of gigs where I'm like not getting there. Like, you know, when you're in the moment because you're like four tracks ahead of the mix in your head, and then there's gigs you play and you're like, you feel like all you're doing is scrolling on the CDJ. You're like, I don't fucking know what to play next. And it's not that it's even a bad gig, but like you're not reaching this like
You're not in tune in the room, the sound, the your ears, your soul maybe is left behind above, you know, 10,000 meters somewhere in the airplane. Mm-hmm. Your body's there, you haven't arrived yet, and you're like trying to kind of touch that frequency and being part of it, and then you're just not there and you can't find the right tracks to get you in there.
I mean, I have to say these days when I'm looking for those moments, you know, to be honest, it's probably different for somebody who's maybe 24 and experiencing for the first time. Like the big thing right now is like the hard groove stuff. Like if you're so at peak time, you're probably like, oh, you get to see this DJ. This is great. And you're feeling that, which is awesome. For me, I'm still looking for those moments. And I find more often than not, it's usually somehow after the peak time, maybe like between 4 and 6 a.m. when, well, to be honest, people are a little more wasted. So they've actually stopped talking finally, because nowadays everybody doesn't shut up.
Yeah.
And, but so they're all like, they're buzzed up. They're just in the groove and everybody's just kind of on that page you're talking about. And the party's way more smooth and like, but still rocking, you know? And you're just like, okay, this is what I paid for. This is why I'm still out.
Exactly. The nocturnal spirits, the characters come out. I call them the shapeshifters.
I call them the freaks, but shapeshifters is probably more pleasant. Yeah. Yes. But that's fun to me, you know? You see that, like, at that time of night, the tourists or the people who are just testing out the waters, they go home. But then at that time, you have, like, the hardcore heads and, yeah, the freaks or the shapeshifters who are always running the toilets or something. But it's like that moment where everybody kind of aligned, like, whoever's still standing, you know? It's really nice.
Yeah, I can wake up and smell that fog machine sometimes.
Yeah, well, that's because you wake up and you didn't take the clothes off after the gig in the hotel, and you're like, oh, God, I got to fly home 6 hours today.
Yeah, yeah. No, not no six-hour flights, please.
Yeah.
Please.
So you brought it up. Let's get into it. You have a new label that you're launching.
Yeah.
It's not your first, but it's the new one.
It's a new project that I'm really keen and happy about, and I finally found my stride to get, you know, into the whole idea of the creative part of creating a label with the artwork and logo and the names, and that whole thing has come back to me, and I feel like I have something to tell as well in the techno realm with techno tracks. And I also find that I play the tracks, which was a sort of a weird case for me. Was that I was releasing a lot of music, but I never really played them myself.
Same.
Yeah, so it was like, I don't know if it was a therapy thing, but I feel like I'm more in line with the sound that I'm also creating and playing. And at the moment, I think the producers, the new generation of producers have inspired me a lot. It's a little bit more minimal, perhaps, in the sense of stripped down sound designs. But it's also perhaps a little bit more on the DJ Thule in the mix kind of tracks that I like to kind of blend tracks together in a different way. Not play tracks that are too arranged, perhaps. Not that doesn't have the marking of the maybe.
They have a progression to them, but it's not exactly like a song, let's say. It's
exactly.
A little bit like there's a beginning and an end to it all.
Yeah, but I'm very focused on how I would myself, how I would mix tracks together. And basically most of these tracks that are coming out, I just released Stunden 01 end of January, and the second will come out in March, sixth of March, and those tracks was made, I would say, end of 2025. So they're pretty fresh still in that aspect. That usually,
wait, end of 25, like a few months ago.
Yeah. So
okay, moment I thought end of 24.
Wait, yeah, I send exactly. Hold on. So a bunch of them I send to you, like in the summer, and you were actually helping me a lot, kicking my ass to feel confident to actually start the label. You really helped me.
Well, I've been saying for years. Well, at first I thought you would restart Inside, your first label, which just didn't happen. But now you're on a new story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if it's... I think it's better to just start from scratch again. And then, you know, that time was with the Inside label that I was running from, I would say, 98 to 2004-ish, mm-hmm. 2005. Why I stopped was the whole business side of it. I was always having conversations with people from the distribution. They were saying, asking for the A1. Where's the A1? Where's the selling track, you know? And when those questions came in, I felt like, you know what? I'm not doing this to sell A tracks. For me, it's a different thing. For me, the fun stuff was the design. It was the pre-work, the mixing, the finding the angle and the story behind, like the concept and all that stuff. But selling the shit was not why I started the label in the first place. Which I guess it's kind of a lucky strike in that sense that you can start a record label and just sell it out of, I don't know, pure.
That was the 90s for you. I remember one of my first records only sold 1,000 copies and it flopped. You know what I mean? That was considered a flop back then.
Yeah.
And then of course you'd sell more records that are not. But actually, do you know this DJ Overland about all from Canada?
Overland.
Yeah. I was just talking to her last week about I believe it was the Inside record you did with Peter Benish.
Yeah.
The purple one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a couple of tracks in there that still
it's an electro track there where I'm singing on, actually.
Yeah, and the vocoder, right?
Yes. Yeah,
yeah, there's that one, and then there's another vocal cut on there.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's saying, but
it's me ripping. Singing. Yeah. So Peter and me, we went to school together. I know him since fourth grade, because his dad was from Germany and my mom is from Germany. So we had 1 hour in the week, German lesson in school. While the other kids were having like the fun hour, we went off to see our German teacher. So that's how I got to know him. So I know known him for a long time, and he also started the Globe Studio together with Adam and Jesper Dahlbeck. So he was part of that Lump Raid trip to 93. He was part of that thing because we were the gang of nerds that was going to rave parties back in this high school that we went to. And also Peter bought the 303 one day. He came to school and he brought it, and he went to Adam went to a normal class. I went to like a little bit more of an aesthetic kind of schooling, and Peter went to music classes. So they had like downstairs in the school, and they had a music room with a guitar amp. And so he plugged in the 303 into that guitar amp, and we were just like blown away by, what's this? This is the thing that makes that sound, you know? Mm-hmm. But for us, it was just all a discovery for what is actually those noises coming out of the speakers. What is that? You know, we didn't know shit about synthesizers or drum machines, and it was all totally blank page.
Yeah.
And so when he got to school with the 303, it was like an epiphany. Like, oh shit, that's the thing that makes that acid sound.
You
live and learn.
And then that's the thing, like back then there was no YouTube to like learn tricks.
No.
You know, because we were talking earlier about how people use the term quote unquote gatekeeping for track lists or whatever.
Right.
But the real gatekeeping was back then with studio tricks and stuff. Like you kind of held things close to your chest or just with your homies because it was all about being ahead of everybody else. I mean, it still is in a way.
It's all trial and error.
Yeah.
You know? And then we met Carrie, which was a big teacher.
Because
he was already in line with he'd released on records labels outside Sweden and had a studio. He was, you know, he knew everything already. So he taught a lot of these tricks.
Yeah,
and he was also mastering all the stuff, pre-mastering stuff before it went to the mastering studios in the UK and stuff.
Was that all the stuff that was being done? Was it upstairs of Planet Rhythm when it was
downstairs?
Record shop?
Downstairs, yeah.
Okay.
So upstairs was the shop, and then there was the office, and then there was a staircase down to the room where Carrie sat. And actually, Carrie left and moved out, and I took over that room. So I was in his old studio room, and that's where I did all the first insides and all the Primeval stuff. And I was working daily upstairs, and then went downstairs recording shit in the afternoon or the evenings. So it was like
crazy.
Yeah, the inspiration was just constant flow back then. Crazy.
And then I guess I just realized for people listening, yeah, back then Planet Rhythm was a record shop and also a label owned by Glenn Wilson at that point. I don't know who owns it now, but they released a lot of the early Swedish stuff because it was essentially a Swedish label in the beginning. And then
exactly. It was the in-house label of the record shop. And that set the formula for everyone getting the platform to create their own labels and just like go for it. Just push.
Totally. And then
amazing times.
You said you did all the early inside stuff there. Mm-hmm. I think the first record I got from you was it Eroticon?
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, Eroticon 6. It's a planet.
69.
It's taken from the Hitchhiker's Guide of the Galaxy. It's a planet where there's a woman with three breasts. It's Eroticon 6.
Yeah. what was it? The meaning of, 46 and 2 is Tool. What was the thing from the Hitchhiker's Guide? What's the meaning of...
I can't remember.
It's been too long.
Yeah, it's been...
That was like something I read when I was...
Yeah, it was a thick book.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pages.
Exactly. Yeah. You were doing all that. You brought we brought up Adam's name quite a bit. Yeah. You ended up on Drum Code Red. Basically a big part of what would become the Stockholm side of techno at that point.
Yeah.
I had Gitana Parisio on here last summer. We were talking about that, how there was a strong connection between Italy, their Neapolitan scene and the Swedish scene. There was a lot of similarities. Theirs was a little bit more about the sun, and rightfully so, Sweden seemed like a little bit more of like the icier, snowier version of
it all. It's a weird thing. I don't know. It's something with the groove and the sound structure, and probably also the way we got inspired by Detroit and the Belgium sound, and there was some sort of deeper, I don't know, tribal connection there. I don't know why, but.
Well, Jeff Mills had a lot of influence
of
it.
Of course.
Yeah. But I think what it comes down to is, that was still in a period where, the internet existed, of course, but it was not broadband internet as we know. So, there was a very limited amount of media that could get through, meaning things you could actually hear or even watch online. There was no YouTube. There wasn't, MP3s was barely even being shared at one point, because there's still dial-up connections. So I guess what I'm getting at is regions still had regional flavor to it, and that wasn't just a techno thing. That's like why you'd have your West Coast hip-hop. It was way different than your East Coast hip-hop in the 90s, and little local scenes have different vibes because you just are all hanging out together, creating music together, inspired by each other, even if you don't want to admit to it, because back then when you're a young teenage guy, especially girls too, but just you're like, fucking, this is for me, and we want to be the best or whatever. But it's like this competition and stuff, and pushing each other, but really trying to go for it. Now, if you're an aspiring producer, you're not just going to with or against your people in your town. It's like against the world. You got to
You're flying
reach
solo.
Out for noise.
Yeah, you're flying solo. You don't have anyone to really communicate with in the same sense of. I always felt like playing tracks for a friend, whether it be if you produce something, if you have that extra set of ears and or a soul or a mind that is actually listening to what you're doing, you all of a sudden kind of get in a in a state of mind where you want to kind of create something that the listener or that person in the room also can connect to, and that little connection that is between you and the second person, or if you're more people in the room listening to a track together, it kind of enhances the way of you're willing to be at your best. Like, you want to tell the story, like, hey man, can you see this, what I'm trying to do? And it's such an abstract thing. You're creating something from nothing and creating your own soul out of it. And of course, then you're affecting people around you, and then all of a sudden you have a sound going on, and then this becomes a bigger circle, and then all of a sudden you have a movement and a community. And I think with the record shop, for an example, for that time period where we were in, when everyone was still buying records, there was no digital format, you had to dig, you had to create dig, you had to find your connection with the music, and being able to also work and sell records was a nice thing to have experienced, because now you're not only digging for yourself and your own sets, you're also kind of want to try and find the music that the person in the store is searching for. So you're like giving the person an option of like, what are you looking for, what kind of label, what kind of producer, what country, what flavor are you into, is it Detroit, blah blah blah, all these kind of options of being the librarian in the record shop is an amazing feeling when you find the right moment and you see the glow in a person's eye saying like, oh, wow, I really like this. That connection when you're actually transmitting, look, check this record out, you I think you're gonna like that.
Oh, yeah.
And then you notice that they're into it, then that's also a really nice feeling.
Yeah, definitely.
Selection.
I can agree to that. Like when I used to do the record buying, I did all the techno and stuff for this shop called Vital Vinyl. I don't know if you were ever there in Minneapolis at that point.
No, but remember that we never really had time to go by, because it was, maybe it was a Sunday.
It was also kind of getting to the era where records were becoming less of a thing.
Maybe.
Anyway, like, you know, while I was already traveling at that point, but there were still plenty of weekends where I was hanging out with friends and we would just sit in each other's bedrooms and play records for 8-10 hours, playing Tony Hawk on the TV and ripping bongs and playing records and that kind of stuff you do when you're younger.
Yeah.
And then when it came time to ordering, I knew kind of what to order because I knew what people were playing. So when people came in, I think for a while it was actually Tuesdays at our shop because the European orders arrived late. And then, of course, Friday, like many shops, there's kind of 2-day drops.
Right.
Everybody would pile in because at that point, you know, web forums were coming a thing, but it was still kind of a cultural collection point to like meet up at the record shop, get the new rave flyers and shit.
Yeah.
But I'd be like, I would just start pulling out records for people. Like, I know you're going to be into this. I know you could be into that. And like, not to toot my own horn, but I'd say like 80 to 90% of the recommendations I gave to these people, they bought the shit. Because I'm just like, I know you love Kerry Lakebush, here you go, you're gonna love this. Or be like, this one's pretty Detroit-y, you're more into the darker shit, I don't know if you're gonna like it. And of course they didn't, or you know what I mean. So knowing your audience.
Yeah, I think it's nice to have someone. It's like the same, you're getting presented a good wine to a certain type of food in a restaurant, someone who knows what flavor is gonna fit perfect, you know. And it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I mean, these days it's the way where a smaller equivalent is like, oh, so-and-so will love this meme, fire it off on the phone, you know, and you wait for the LOL to come in.
Yeah.
You have the new label.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Is it digital only or is it on?
It is only digital at the moment.
Okay.
So I'm doing the promotion myself and the artwork and actually Carrie has helped me mastering the tracks and also helped with the back structure of the promotion service. So he's actually coded the whole thing. So I got a lot of help from him. And
shout out.
Ooh. And Petter B has been helping me with the extra care of the design thing, just to have a look out and everything looks okay. But apart from that, it's just in-house, and I'm fired up. I'm really excited, like Firehorse 2026, you know, good, awesome. Good vibes. That's let's right. go.
With yeah. the new label, I've yeah. heard it. For those who haven't heard it yet, I mean, it is absolutely Joel 100%, like unapologetically, like it couldn't be anybody else, I don't think. And, you know, listening to these tracks, I think about, okay, well, where would you put these tracks out if you weren't putting them on your label? And I say this in a good way. I think that, like, it's hard to find a place that would fit those because it is, the music's kind of singular and it is its own thing. Like, it's very clubby and optimistic and stuff, but it's not, I think a lot of stuff these days when you hear, like, clubby and optimistic or happy or something, you might think of Mark Broom or Rob Hood or that kind of stuff, which is nothing wrong with that, but it's like there's a kind of a defined way of what club techno is, and your stuff is still very clubby, but has, I don't know, like maybe a little bit more of a softer emotional impact on it or something. You know what I mean? Not so aggressive, bro. I don't know the words I'm looking for.
Yeah, there's always like a little melody going on somehow. Like
it's
a
playful.
Little, yeah, it has some little soulfulness in baked into it. I just can't get away from it. And also I'm a sucker for pads and shit, but these tracks doesn't have that many pads, actually. I think one of the tracks has a string or something, but I don't know. I'm pretty happy. I'm playing the tracks, which I was saying, like that's unusual for me, and that's a good sign, and I'm fired up about it. It's really excitement 3.56.
Yeah,
you know, it's come through so many cycles of labels and techno and ups and downs through my whole career, and again I'm feeling like I didn't feel this way, I would say, 2 years ago. 2 years ago I was just doing ambient and I couldn't make techno at all. I wasn't really feeling that I had anything to say to the current development of the music, but this time around I feel like there's been a lot of good tracks that I'm getting inspired by. So I think that's the key of it all. What is actually inspiring you and giving you like a feeling that you want to be creating techno and actually listening to techno? Because, yeah.
So what got you back on to the techno wagon? Was there anything, or you just it finally clicked?
Yeah, I guess it's just. It's hard to say, actually. I think I've been running an ambient club once a month in Stockholm, and this has kind of got me back to it. Kind of resets my mind every month. I go into this hypnotic ambient state flow, and then I kind of get inspiration again to get into more energetic stuff. So it's like monthly, I have this cycle going on now where I start the month with making techno, and then in the end of the month I'm doing ambient. So
what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
I got my hands in different pots and stuff. And
yeah. So
I think it's kind of necessary, right? To stay excited.
Step out of it and kind of get a vision, a view from far away. And also, of course, gigs have been really good as well and inspiring. And also I'm doing a residency in a club in Stockholm, which is a little bit more on the clubbier side, like Panorama Bar vibes it trying to get a little bit into the techno world, not too. When you mentioned like the clubby side of techno, that I don't know. I like to be in that kind of environment where it's not too decided for. It's just one style. I like when it's when you're able to play a full set, like 1 to 5. You can just build up from house into techno and then build it down and go melodic, or you know, when you have this whole full circle. That's where I like to be.
Yeah, I'm in that wheelhouse too. And I think it's an old school thing. You know, I can't remember if I brought this up on a recent podcast or not, but all the time, still when I play out, it would drive me nuts because promoters or fans afterwards would be like, "Oh, it was so good! Like, you have such an old school way of playing." And I wouldn't be offended. But it would kind of stress me out because I do put a lot of time and effort into trying to play the newest shit.
Yeah.
You know, and like really keeping my ear to the ground for what's cool. Like, I am dismissive of trends, but if there's something cool in that trend, I have no problem playing it, you know? And also I think of, you know, maybe people like, you know, my dad or his friends, these people who they're like only into classic rock forever. You know what I mean? Like, people just like they whatever they liked until they're 28 or something, that just kind of becomes their thing. I don't want to be the guy that only plays the bells or some shit, you know? Nothing wrong with that. I'm always trying harder. So I'm like, I would get pissed off. But now I only really recently figured it out in the last 6 to 12 months. I'm like, oh yeah, it's that ability to play a little bit of everything and like a little bit of emotion. Cause then when I start paying attention to how the newer gens are playing, it's very dialed in to like sort of one sound or whatever. And I don't even mean that in a negative way. In fact, I wish I could play a little bit more, like keeping it all in that pocket for a while, but I can't. I'm like, you know what? The next record's got to be something fucking nuts. And then the next one after that, it's deeper or whatever. To me, that's fun. That's a story.
Yeah. I think it's just the way the night goes. If you have the same style the whole night, it's just, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said for like being able to do that all night and have it still be cool. Some people really love that.
Sure.
I think if I was still in my 20s, I would probably be...
But
that's all I wanted to hear in my 20s.
I think it's from experience as well. If you would have time to experience to play in a club where you would actually play 5-6 hours... you wouldn't play the same sound. But when you get booked to play 2 hours or 1 hour or, you know, festival gigs and only play a certain amount of fire, you know, then sure, I understand that it goes really well. But I also like when you, if you do the analogy with fire, you know, I like to watch when the fire burns down and it's just like, the cold bed, like going to see glowing, you know, the aspect of having these different phases of the night is a beautiful thing. And I think you need to have the time and experience to maybe start telling stories like that. Because that's just a form of storytelling. And some people come from a tribe that tells that kind of story, and they have their, you know, rhythms, you know, and every city, every club, every part of the world has their little tribe where the frequencies and the rhythms and the dance is unique. So,
I mean, I think it's just an important aspect, because anytime you think of, think of your favorite album, doesn't matter what genre it's in, you're going to have the bangers on the album, the excited ones, and then there's the deeper cuts, the more mellow things. And
I was always the B2 guy, man.
Yeah absolutely. You start, even as you get older, like you go back towards some of these albums that you listen to all the time as a teenager, and you're like, oh, I like the first four tracks or whatever. But then, you know, it hits differently when you're 29 or something and you hear that 11th track on the CD. You're like, actually, this one is awesome.
You know what? I have that with English. I've been listening to so much music during my teens where I didn't know what they were singing about.
Oh, I bet.
So, like, my English, I was okay, but I was never paying attention of the lyrics. Mm-hmm. I was always listening to the sounds behind. What was the pads, or what was the vibe of the track? Not, and then the guy was singing about him getting laid, or I don't know, yeah, soul crushing experience with love or whatever. I've discovered tracks.
It changes everything.
Recently,
right?
That has been like, what?
Yeah.
I
have bands where, you know, like, this song sounds really happy. And like you, when I was younger, I didn't really care about the lyrics. I was like, I either like the song or not, the beats and whatever.
Yeah.
And then as you get older, you start actually paying attention to the stuff. And you're like, well, this is actually a sad ass song, but it's packages something happy, you know? And then once I improved my skills as a producer and I was traveling around the world a bunch and working on other genres, I'm like, I'm going to go back and revisit a bunch of the stuff I listened to when I was younger, see what holds up and what doesn't. Mm. It's fascinating to see what still makes the cut. Like, you'd be surprised.
Mm.
But then you also like can really appreciate the production and the writing a lot more. Or you're like, wow, this is really primitive compared to what I thought it was, you know?
Yeah, it's a great, I mean, also songwriting. I was never a good songwriter. I was more, it was always about tracks.
Yeah.
I love arrangements. I love mixing. But I was never really focusing on writing a good song or a good track like that. It was always like a blank canvas every time. It still is. Maybe I have templates set up and stuff, but usually not. It's always based on feelings and what kind of colors and tones and space I'm looking for.
You're definitely going to get that out of your music, you know, because there's sometimes where producers, actually we were talking about that earlier, how like a lot of this stuff now is technically extremely proficient, but there's no feeling or emotion. But every time your tracks, whether a person is going to be into your track or not is a different story, but they can't deny that there's going to be a feeling attached to it. Like the, I can't think of many tracks of yours where you're just like, all right, there wasn't an idea or a intention for mood, you know?
Yeah, I'm a sucker for reverbs and pads, and I think that's my upbringing in being a choir singer, you know. I've been all my youth I was singing in choirs. So in Stockholm I probably sang in every church, and there's something with a church acoustic and the reverb and just plain voice spacing out in a reverb that is just, it's just the foundation of me in a way. And I'll try and subconsciously it's probably there all the time, also when I play in a club, and trying to get that kind of enhanced flavor of open space in the music, but also being, you know, tough and hypnotic and pumping and funky. And I always had that kind of nerve in my music and how I wanted to present music in a loud format that would take you on some sort of journey. And that's how I mix as well. I love when you can go maybe four or five tracks and you don't really feel like it's a separate track. You might just have that long crescendo of A to B with all these tracks, but then you would do a drop and then you would kind of do a break and get to the next level kind of thing.
Totally. letting the curation kind of do the talking.
Yeah, right? But also the thing with hypnotizing myself as well. And I was probably never the wedding DJ kind of type. Like
just
I would,
banging in the hits.
You know, yeah. getting everyone to dance. That's not my strong suit, but
Don't sell yourself short. You do. You get them going.
I'm gonna end up at what's it called? I can't come up with the word.
Uh-oh, someone needs another coffee. By the way,
yeah, it's Sunday evening and I had a late night. Sorry.
Yeah. So, what about the States? Are you?
Yeah, situation. The situation now is my visa ran out and I haven't renewed it yet. First, it's ridiculously expensive, and I feel like I'm putting money aside to other things at the moment. Let's see. Maybe there's some sort of sponsorship that will happen, but no gigs in the US. I've had my visa for over 10 years, I would say longer than that. There was a time when things didn't run with visa, but that's an off mic session. But hopefully, I don't know. I have to look into that.
It's going to be an interesting period for techno going forward, because I know of a lot of European artists who are not renewing their visas.
Yeah, okay,
for
so that's
various
the thing.
Reasons.
Okay,
you know, some of it's political, some of it's the money.
Mm.
So for people who don't know or understand, really, if you are a European that wants to DJ in America, you can come in under the radar on the ESTA visa. That's illegal, technically, but that's what some do. But once you start talking about doing a bigger string of shows or, you know, bigger money, you have to have a visa, more or less. And that visa, actually, RA wrote a nice article on this for anybody that's curious.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, I think it's around 3,000 normally in it to apply for a visa, which there's no guarantee you'll get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes right now upwards of a year, and that's if you pay the other processing fee, which is a total of 6,000, and then there's lawyer costs and stuff. So it's really expensive. It's only good for 3 years. And what a lot of people don't know when they're getting these visas is that you agree to have your taxes withheld.
Yeah.
30%.
That's the kicker. So I can't get that tax back either.
Yeah.
So I pay tax in the States, and I can't deduct it in Sweden.
Yeah.
So I'm paying double tax.
Yeah,
and I'm paying for a visa, so it's like going over. It's more like a promotion thing,
exactly.
And it's not fun to promote. And I love playing and DJing, but I don't, you know, I'm not into promoting myself endlessly. It's not why I'm here.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
exactly.
And, unfortunately. But it's the state of affair at the moment, and what's going on in your country at the moment is just I don't know. It's weird, crazy. It's a weird fucking moment, and it's been weird for a moment, and it will continue for a moment. So I don't know.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people in the same.
It's sad boat. Because I think culture shouldn't be. You know, it should be easier than it is, you know, to be able to give people some sort of good escape and cultural lifestyle, and not only about the money, you know. It's
absolutely I mean, it's interesting because in America it's definitely becoming sort of a classist thing to some degree to go to festivals and stuff like that. You know, the final tier of tickets for the Great Beyond, I think, are $275 plus services and fees and taxes and shit. And then some of these other bigger festivals, $400, I think. You know, some of these rock ones like Coachella or whatever, I want to say it starts at $600, and then of course it goes up with the VIP packages for a 3-day weekend or something.
It's ridiculous.
You know, it's really hard for a lot of these people to be able to afford it.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you have like Live Nation. They have their monopoly. So even if you want to go hear singers, bands, whatever, in your local venues, those are all kind of owned and managed by companies. So it's a weird time for music. There is cool things going on for sure. I think all over in the world,
yeah,
here in Europe and
US at the moment, I would say it's super well curated and so many great new gangs, people doing really proper, good, curated parties with quality music, and also for like proper underground venues and not only clubs, and it's a pickle because I really want to be able to play in the States. I have so many friends, and it's been a long relationship with the US since the 90s.
Absolutely.
And it's a bit sad that, you know, this is have to be the issue, but yeah, and that's another thing with this our culture being labeled as a in the end of the day, it's all show business and everyone needs to sell tickets and etc. I think just at the moment it's just it's too much competition and too many people being able to buy their way to be able to get the front cover. And that was always the case, but these days is even worse. So there's a lot of people suffering and a lot of people not being able to get their voice heard and cut through the white noise of things. Which is it's a dark side of this whole thing. I'm trying to stay positive here, but
But it's funny you mentioned it because we were talking about the 90s and early 2000s and stuff. And remember back then we would complain that like, oh, everybody's a DJ, or there's too many DJs or whatever. But compared to now, it's crazy because like you said, you just of the draw. You got a job as a resident DJ at 19, not really having any formal background or even popularity at that point. You just were thrown into it. Now you have the whole world fighting for if that position even exists, and usually they're just going to keep cycling through to whoever can bring the most people in the door.
Yeah, sure.
So I feel for people these days.
I think with any culture that reaches the arena stage, when that point of time, that's always going to be where the popularity is going to be. So for example, in the 80s you would have all the rock bands and then they would go on stage and everyone wants to be a rock band.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing going on with our culture, techno and dance music and whatnot. Everyone wants to be a DJ, and it's the same kind of cycle, but it's just a new format of instruments and performances. And yeah, I prefer the darker club towards the big stage on a personal level.
Same.
Yeah.
I do better. I actually like, I played a good number of festival gigs last year for the first time in a while, and it was fun, and I think I did all right. I know I did better than usual in those settings because I'm not super thrilled about my festival performances usually, but I definitely feel more suited at a small club, small being like what, 400-700 people, something like that, even a little smaller, but I like that size.
You want to be on the floor. That's my point of view. I feel like I lose some sort of connection with people when I'm far away on a higher stage, and it's just when I'm on that pedestal, I don't feel comfortable. It depends, you know. Of course, you know, you have Fusion Turmbühne and, you know, other kind of festivals like Nation of Gondwana. But then you know that the people behind it is there all year long to create that spirit of environment where everyone feels at home, and you're not just buying a plastic cup of Heineken labeled, I don't know, Dorito chips, fries.
Exactly.
To watch your favorite big pop artist.
I mean, that's just it. Like, I have to say, like, some of these big money festivals, they can be kind of fun, and people are pretty happy and optimistic when you walk around at them. But, you know, you brought up Nation of Gondwana, you brought up Fusion. Mm. Those are both more on the hippie, hedonistic side of things, which is
actually quite similar to
the Great Beyond.
Yeah.
Counterculture in a way, but, like, let's say more leftist counterculture. In a little bit more anarchist in some regards.
Yeah, for sure. Sure.
You know, and having worked in those environments and played in those environments, there's a certain, like you said, a comfort or whatever, like happiness level that they bring to those parties that it takes a lot of work to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also insanely chaotic behind the scenes in some of that, because it's like you're not hiring. I mean, yeah, some people get paid, of course, but a lot of these people are kind of volunteers, are doing it for very little money, because they're like, I want to see where this goes. Mm. Both those parties you mentioned are massive now. I mean, Fusion's significantly bigger, I think eight times bigger.
Yeah.
But they're both gigantic, and they're powered by people who truly give a shit, and they want to see, they like this chaotic, fun thing that isn't, like you said, the Doritos, 10-euro taco, whatever, bullshit things. Like it's more real, more raw, you know.
Yeah, and it's clean, and it's like people take care of things, you know. The whole idea with also, like, just if you buy a bottle of beer, you can bring it back, and then you get a font back. Just that little thing makes it more cleaner. People take care of the surroundings more.
Totally.
They're more aware of. It's not a show off. Maybe,
exactly.
It just ticks the boxes in my experience. Where what kind of party I myself would like to experience.
What do you want to go? What do you want to see? And like, it kind of lets you go back to being that person again, right?
Yeah.
I ran into someone when I played Fusion last year, and she was actually just there to party and not really as a DJ. She was totally in goblin mode, like really going for him. Like, I didn't know you would be here. And I was like, you look like you're in goblin mode. She's like, yeah, 100%. Like, in it to win it. Like,
because it's an experience itself just to be there, wandering around, and all the art stuff, all the installations, and
it's people
making an effort to like create a different environment and space where you can just fantasize.
Totally. You know, and it somehow works. Some work, like at all these things, some of the workers can be really good, and others are like too high to pour you a beer or something. Like, that's just it's funny. It's frustrating if you are the one trying to keep it on the tracks, but it's kind of entertaining as a attendee.
Yeah, you know? 2 beer limit.
Exactly. But you said that you were having in the last couple of years like really good sets and stuff like that. I guess, what are you looking for at this point? I mean, there's the obvious answers, but like, what really does it for you right now? Because obviously there's multiple directions you could have taken. You could have gone more commercial with your sound. You could have gone darker or whatever, but where you're at now, what are you looking for?
Good question. Really good question. I would say, it's a constant like search of inspiration, and what something that helped me get my mind sorted is I started journaling last year, writing down things that I have in my head and get it actually down on paper, and has helped me to get more organized. So in that aspect, I've been able to plan my days better. Sounds crazy. I'm 50 plus and still acting like a kid. I always say good morning, the teenager is awake, to my girlfriend, because I feel like a teenager sometimes, how I don't plan things. But during journaling, it's actually gotten me more organized and also knowing what I want to do in the week. So my plan is to just be more productive and be more making more music this year. And it, so far it's been good. I will focus on Stunden for the time being. We have some stuff going on for Parable as well. A new Patrick Siege release with some remixes. Jolene remix and Evik Mørker remix and a remix by myself. And also...
Explain Parable for those who don't know.
So Parable is... it's a platform that was created by Linda Nilsson, my wife. We're not married, but we've been together for 26 years, and we met on the dance floor. And her idea was to create a booking agency and a label to create a platform and a community to bring people together and push for new artists. And that's a thing we run together. She's the more has more saying, but we discuss things, what we want to release, and we listen to music and demos and stuff. But basically, the idea was to kind of give the people that are on the booking agency also a platform to release music, or vice versa. And it became, I think, Patrick has been the one releasing most tracks on the label. So big, big shout out to Patrick Siege from Malmö.
There you go.
Yeah. You guys have to book him. He's an amazing DJ as well.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. And so your question was, what's the plan musically or just...
I guess just like when you... playing out, like what are you looking for? Like we said, like for example, you like playing in smaller clubs or something, but like for you, like what are the kind of gigs that you want
to
be?
So I'm lucky in a position to be playing a panorama set, a techno set, and an ambient set. So I'm comfortable with doing all of these things because it inspires me to tell different stories. And not being locked into one specific sound. So we have a club in Stockholm called Noi, which is downstairs in the basement of an old venue called Barnes. And they have a beautiful sound system, a Function One, perfectly set up. And the booth is amazing. The closing hour is 5 o'clock and it opens midnight. So I've created like I'm running a club night called Mosaic, two times every season. So I have in the fall season I do two dates, and then the spring season I do two dates, and then I play all like longer journeys, like five hours, and then I do the ambient night once a month, where I play 7 hours of ambient music, and then I do weekend shows where I. Usually when I play abroad, I play more of a techno style thing, like more hypnotic kind of Berlin
beat and shit.
Yeah, I always call it when the train start running, you know, the engine is rolling, that kind
it's
of techno.
It's definitely the Joel Mull Express, yeah. For sure.
So, yeah, I'll continue to try and be in all these formats. I love to be able to jump in and out in these different formats because it's just that's what's the most important thing is to have fun with it and being inspired by all of this. Otherwise, just one day you wake up and you just think everything's boring and you can't connect with it. And this helps me connect with all these different styles and of music.
Yeah, I get that sometimes, the waking up and trying to connect with the music and not really catching the groove, quote unquote. And so it can be tough, it can be troublesome. Or like, let's say you have a really killer gig coming up that's kind of a big deal, and you know, it's stressing, but you're like, what do I do for this?
Yeah.
You know, like, how do I deliver?
Mm-hmm.
And lately I've just been trying to keep reminding myself, like, what is, you know, the essence of all this, of techno, or like, what makes it so great? Like, trying to reduce it down to that again. Or like, if I'm like, I don't know what to play, and all, like, I get new stuff all the time, and then I don't always play all of that, some of it. But it's like, what makes a drum track so great? What makes this Detroit techno track so amazing with the soul? You know, like, the things that, trying to remember what gets you excited in the beginning, and are those things strong enough to keep you excited decades later? You know, keep trying to think of that.
Yeah, that's a really good angle. And also, you know, business sides of things, being an artist, a self-made and self-employed, and pushing yourself and creating something out of nothing, it's always going to be as like a pressure, a constant pressure. But and I try not to dwell on that too much. You know, that it's not, we're not competing. It's just you telling a story and trying to get people on your journey and come along with you and try and show yourself and open this little portal of fantasy, that where you can just be in that moment. And that's where it all boils down to. And I think it's, everyone goes through phases where they're like, oh shit, what am I going to do? But
I think it's every job, everything.
Take a pause, step back, do something different, you know. And journaling, really good. And I'm really into pens now these days. I'll scroll on a site.
No shit.
And I look into, like, Japanese stationery pens.
Oh my God, yeah. You're getting into it. I have this theory that most of the pens no longer work well, and the pens will go extinct. Well, the second part maybe is a little drastic, because it's like nobody uses pens that much anymore. So every time you go to grab a pen, it's dried out. Even if there's ink in there, it just won't work.
Yeah, you just have to
rub
it.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, you try and get it going and it just doesn't work. And
dude, I wonder
how many of these pens you got to throw away.
Dude, yeah. But if you buy quality pens, you can keep a pen for a lifetime. Like a nice fountain pen.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about those.
Ooh, it's nice stuff. And you write, you know, you learn how to... The thing is also this connection with getting your thought out on via your hand on the piece of paper just makes a connection, and it just sits with you instead of you writing down a note on a screen. For me, the screen thing is so numbing and can be so delusional. It almost feels like you didn't do anything. There's no physical form of attachment anymore. It's just like this weird, with the physical form and writing. And also I started to sketch a lot as well, making one sketch a day.
Just doodling
and it helps.
I like all those kind of things. I mean, even if it's not sketching, but something to like get the brain thinking even just a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
So you brought up the fountain pens. It's interesting because I've been asking this question to friends lately at dinners and stuff.
Yeah.
How would I phrase this? Because it's not even a thing about being in your 40s or some shit.
Mm-hmm.
How are we doing on time?
Oh, it's
we're doing okay.
It's okay.
we'll wrap it up before too long. The thing is, as you get older, you finally like buy something or start doing something, and you're like, oh my God, how did I go my whole life without this? And now I can't. Like, for example, one of my more recent things was merino wool socks. Ooh, like in the winter, you know?
Okay.
And actually, you can get them cheap enough now where you can get a pack of three of them for nothing. But I was like, wow, I could have used this 15 years ago or even longer. So is it depends for you? Or is there something else in recent years where you're like, I wish 20-year-old Joel would know that this was the way?
Ooh. That's the thing, man. Constant learning.
That's
like,
true.
That's the thing that keeps it interesting. It's like, learn something every day. I think that's the key of things. Just get inspired by any kind of dope shit that goes on, like YouTube. I go on YouTube and I find this nerd who's totally into making a zine. I actually made a little zine for my ambient night last month. An 8-page scene that I printed on an A4 paper with these small, like I was doing the artwork and everything and text and photos and stuff. And I got totally caught up in it. And so I was doing graphics and one day and then studio the other day. And, you know, I think things get more fun when you mix up things.
Yeah,
and learn new things, and new pen is amazing. New paper, piece of paper, a new journal. And, you know, this is excitement to me. And your
scrapbooking and stuff.
Yeah,
but I mean, I think there's something to be said. You're talking about the zine, but just like kind of creating these small things. You know, we were talking earlier about
some
the
physical
t-shirts that we put out.
Yeah,
that's fun. It doesn't even have to be fancy stuff. Like maybe getting keychains or something. It's cool to bring something into the world from your brain to reality.
It's a little token of something.
Sometimes it's cheap stuff, like people give it to you, like on the road as DJs. How many hundreds of shirts do we get from promoters and record labels?
Thank you.
But I mean, like it's sometimes you don't think much of it at the time, but then some of it you hang on to, and then 10 years later you're like, that was an awesome party, or that label was dope, or maybe you get that zine, and it's just, or old flyers even.
Yeah.
Because nobody does paper flyers anymore, or posters.
That's exactly my point why I started the zine thing, because I wanted to leave something that is physical, that is actually a proof that it actually happened. Because we promote everything online these days. You do a video, or you do a post, or whatever, and then it's gone. It's just like, whoops.
Yeah.
But the physical form, okay, vinyl, yeah, I understand that. But it's also a really expensive form of tokens. And but I think everything that you leave behind as a little physical form creates value. And it's a nice thing to see if someone picks it up and like looks at it. And just that connection is...
Little mementos or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So you brought up, everything's online now.
Yeah.
And you brought up journaling. Those are actually two things, like if I had to reflect on my career, like, oh, what do I not regret doing? I don't have a whole lot of regrets. Of course I have some. But actually, there's many times where I convince myself after a party, like, I'm going to start journaling and writing down each night on the road how it went, if it was shit, what was great, or what records popped or whatever. I think I started and stopped like three different times over the years. I did that one gig and that was it. And I really wish I had the book, the notebook, or the files on the computer where I could be like, so that's how it was in Lyon in 2014. I never did that.
It's never too late to stop or start.
Well,
just do it. Get those small notebooks, you know, easy to put in your pocket.
Yeah, something like
cheap
that.
Cheap pen, whatever.
Cheap. If you do cheap, that's fine. I have fancy pens, but cheap pens, no big deal.
You can get a very cheap fountain pen from me as a gift.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I love your cheap fountain pen. But, and then the flyers thing, because you don't get to save them anymore. I thought, taking screenshots even of these Instagram posts or when the promoter sends it.
Yeah.
Like just keeping a folder of all these flyers. I try to do it, but I forget.
Ugh.
And, you know, it would just be cool to be able to look back at some of it. Both, like, some of the flyer designs are incredible and some are bad. Actually, the two worst flyers I've ever been on, I save those because they're so fucking funny. But, and I'm going to post those someday, you know.
I have so many flyers from the 90s up to the 2000s. I have like a big bag, a record bag full, packed.
You need to find yourself a coolest nerd design. Dude, put on put them on Instagram.
It would be really cool to make a book out of it. I know there is it exists some a couple of those UK flyer rave books.
Yeah, man. There's your opening.
Yeah.
Make this. We were talking earlier. You said you wanted some new studio gear.
Okay, so you're starting journaling and I'm going to start doing flyer collections.
Why not?
No, it's good. I think let's go. Let's do it.
Got to have something to do during the summer when things slow down.
Oh, no, in the winter. Summer, I can't work in the studio. I can't do anything. I just want to be outdoors. I just want to make pizzas.
He's a ferocious pizza maker.
Yeah, pizza got me going, man. It's just that uni oven that I bought.
He gets deep into it. What's your hydration level and all that?
I would say like 80, like 70%, 75. Yeah.
Keep tweaking it, or are you kind of set in your way right now?
It's really daily form. It also depends on how cold it is and you know how humidity is the summer. If it's the winter, how warm is the oven? You know how is you know the fermentation of the dough and all that stuff. It's actually nerve wracking sometimes. You just want to get that fluffy, perfect rise. That's the only thing you're after. You know you just push that one, then that little pizza pie in the dough, and then you just see it rises. It's an amazing experience.
I told you he goes hard in the paint when it comes to pizza. I still got to try these. I keep seeing all the pictures, and it makes me hungry.
You have
so it. What's your sauce? Are you keeping it basic?
I keep it very basic. I mean, margarita is just, you know, basic stuff.
San Marzano, a little salt,
tomato,
oil.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very basic. And then, you know, you go with the white pizzas. They are really nice.
But are you vegan or vegetarian?
I'm a pescatarian. I eat fish.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a pescatarian also.
I don't eat red meat or chicken.
No. But you actually put like dairy on the on the white pizzas, cream and stuff.
Mozzarella is Parmigiano, you know, all the Italian good stuff. It's hard not to I can't be vegan in that sense. No.
Yeah, that's probably my main holdout is the cheese.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the worst job you've ever had?
Oh,
I ask this question pretty much every episode.
I haven't had many jobs.
That's true. You started DJing early.
Yeah.
So I could probably say DJing.
I was, yeah.
Also the best job.
The best and the worst. I actually worked at the place where they were selling I remember what they were. It was some catalog thing. I was working in the back in the packing things. I only had that job for a couple of months. I wasn't good in showing up at work. And then I worked at Klaviyo, was building Nord leads and D drums and all that stuff. But I got fired. Because I slept on the job. It was on a Monday. I'd probably be out raving all weekend, and they caught me. I was just exhausted after lunch.
I mean, that's to be expected at a certain age, I guess, right?
Yeah. So I hold on to that job for 3 months. And what else? Record shop. And... I don't know if you call that a job, but I was studying through the pandemic, through the 2 years of COVID. I decided I had to kind of do something because I was going nuts, and also I was afraid of, you know, if
music
the cuts,
being over.
Yeah, music being over, and like it shocked me pretty, pretty hard, and I started studying and become a solar engineer, So I did that for 2 years, but I was studying and then I was just doing an internship. That's it. That's my career. It goes pretty quick. It's not many sentences.
That's okay, though. we're actually getting pretty far ahead, and we got to get you to the airport soon. But I would be criminal for the studio nerds here not to ask a few studio questions before you hit the road here. On the new label, I noticed everything sounds really great. You know, are you doing a lot of it in the box, or is it still kind of in and out? Or
some stuff is recorded out with like a Moog, a synthesizer, the Subharmonicon, and I do a couple of effect chains out of the box, but pretty much everything is in the box. And I was always a big sample guy, so I was always using samples. Even since the beginning of my career, I was brought up with samples, not synthesizers. So my first piece of kit was an Ensoniq EPS, which was, I could sample.
That was the keyboard, right?
Yeah, it was the keyboard.
I think that's the one that Arl did the,
I think it was
Groove Accord on.
Yeah, it was a similar thing. No, he was using something else, but it was from the same brand, Ensoniq. But basically, you could sample 1 minute of stereo. That's it. And you had to truncate all
that.
That's
quite a bit of sample time at that point.
Yeah, true. Yeah. But I think it was, can it be mono? Was it stereo? I'm not sure. Yeah, it was stereo. But basically sampling records and just sequencing everything in the sampler and just arranging it and recording it on tape and that's it. Crazy. My first tracks were just made through the DJ mixer with the sampler and then straight on tape.
No shit. That's, wow.
Yeah.
And the sequencer was solid enough.
It had its own
weird
flavor.
Was it
weird
a song
flavor.
Mode, or did you just flip through patterns on a sequencer?
Sometimes song mode, but usually it was just on flipping through the keys.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, so the keys would trigger the pattern.
Like kind of the...
Just go right up the octave?
Not the keys like that, but the buttons. Like you would do step buttons, and then you would have one sequence, and then you would have recorded the drums and another samples and just trying to create a track out of it. But mostly no effects or anything.
I mean, the one thing that I found interesting, and I've been lucky enough to pretty much get to know all of you Swedish guys over the years and figure out, see the studios, see what's going on inside and out and whatever, and obviously some very nice gear at points, but like even when things started going particularly well for people, the studios were still, for lack of better wording, like a little understated.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was like buying 1176s and that, you know? Like it still felt very bedroom oriented.
Yeah, for sure. You know? There was not much money getting thrown on equipment.
But it was all about the results, which I think is great, you know? Because like Kerry was explaining his first sort of studio rack with stuff, and even being in Adam's studio, you're just like, okay, you got it done with this, which is a cool thing, because I think a lot of people think you to this day still have to have cool shit, or when you start making buttloads of money, you got to upgrade the studio, and you're just like,
no, not at all. That's not true.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and we touched the subject before you were mentioning. That's like there's so many rules, like you can't mix like this and that, and this whole. Everyone is so focused on it has to be mixed like this, and it has to be. It's all a flavor, and you can get really good results with less.
Absolutely.
Actually. You don't need all the plugins, guys.
Yeah. But we have them.
Yeah.
And we could do a whole talk on those, but. I realized you have to take the taxi to get to the train, so we gotta get you out of here.
Get going. Thank
I had
you.
A good time.
Yeah, me you too. Know, I had a wonderful Sunday afternoon with you, Dustin.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, man. I'm glad you're we finally did it.
We tried to do this before, actually, in Stockholm. Yeah. I fucked up the recording and got Joel a little lit up in the process.
Yeah, and we were drunk too, right?
Yeah, it was day drinking.
Yeah.
So this is a more behaved version.
It was.
Without notes, but it was fun. I think it went well. So.
Happy we did it. Finally. Yeah. I'm on train wreck.
That's right.
Legendary.
He loves that button. All right, everybody. Have a good one.
Ciao.